Hello, listeners. This is David Licken, and this is a special podcast. Every once in a while, we produce these special podcasts because it's an item of great importance and something I want you to focus on. And quite frankly, it's a longer topic that we could fit in the Hot Topics segment of our regular podcast. There was an article published by Jim Parrott on December 20th about what to expect from Calabria's leadership at FHFA, or the Federal Housing Finance Agency. If you have not already read this article, there's a link on our website on this specific podcast. So go find that if you're listening to this in your mobile device or in your car, however you listen. Go to the website, lickitonlending.com. Make sure you click on that link and read that article. And then listen to it. It'd be best if you read that article and then listen. It'll help put this interview you're about to hear in context. So without further ado, let's get over to Jim Parrott and David Stevens. Well, let's start off with this. First of all, folks, listeners, we're going to be talking about the article that has been published by Jim Parrott, and we're going to get into that. But first of all, I think it's important we get an update on what's going on with David Stevens and with Jim, and then how you two have collaborated and come together and kind of what you're up to. So, David, give us an update. Since you've left the MBA, you've been on quite a journey.
Well, I left the MBA September 30, and since then, I've realized that I've sort of failing the whole concept of retirement, but as is in the news, Dynex Capital, which is a real estate investment trust, just voted me onto their board of directors, and so I'm doing some of that kind of stuff. I'm also helping to advise a variety of different companies in the space. I'm doing some writing for a new platform called Mortgage Media, and I'm still obviously staying close to the policy arena. And you know, Jim and I worked so closely in the administration when he remained in the administration and I was at MBA. And there were a group of us who were very focused on primarily GSE reform, but a variety of other housing issues. So I still work in, and dabble in that sphere as well.
Is that where you and Jim met, was in the Obama administration? Or did you know of each other before that?
No, we didn't know each other before that. I was FHA commissioner and Jim came on to be an advisor to the secretary. And he and I both actually cut our teeth a bit, Jim, on the first actuarial working with the Inspector General's office at the time, because we knew there was that was going to be a challenging process to get through the first time FHA had to announce that they were below the 2% threshold. And so we really got tied together during that. And then from there, when he went to the White House, became such a key leader in the administration's housing policy, I participated in a lot of those meetings with what we call the housing team, where we met frequently to work on housing issues.
So, Jim, you met David Stevens, our beloved leader of our industry, for so long. And so I kind of asked the big question was, what was your first impression when you met David?
So, as Dave mentioned, we actually both entered HUD at almost the same time, and within a week or two of each other. And when we walked in the door, neither of us had been in government service before, so it was all a little...
Both of you had not. All right.
Yeah, a little overwhelming and surreal. For anyone who's not been in government, walking into HUD of all places, which has its own ecosystem to it, is an inherently confusing thing. And we walked in at a moment when the FHA's capital reserve, sort of implied capital reserve, the MMI fund, had fallen below its statutory mandate. So
I remember that.
The secretary basically looked at me and said, go figure out what this is and explain to me, you know, what our risks are and how to manage it. And so Dave and I, who'd never met before, ended up sort of attached at the hip managing this unfolding mess that neither of us really knew a whole lot about in advance. And what was interesting about it was it forced us to get to know very quickly the Inspector General, sort of Congress's role of oversight in this. The White House got involved very quickly when they had heard that we'd fallen below this threshold. And so we ended up having to navigate this very complicated, charged ecosystem very quickly. So we went from not knowing each other at all to knowing each other all too well in about a month.
Wow. Well, sometimes crisis can bring us all very close very quickly, and it's out of necessity. So I applaud you for that. Now, for our listeners, those of you, you know David Stevens, you know his background, but if you don't, I recorded first episode of On Lickin on Leadership. We recorded an interview of David's background. I encourage you to go listen to it. We're going to have a link to our in our show notes of this podcast there so you can go click on that. But Jim, before you ended up
in the administration. Talk about your background and kind of what brought you to the place where you're at today.
Okay. So before I was in the administration, I was an attorney for the better part of a decade handling sort of complex civil litigation matters. And then I was the director of policy on the Obama campaign in 2008 in North Carolina, the down where I am now. And when they asked where I would like to wind up within the administration, or rather I had to sort of sort out where I wanted to be in the administration because I was interested in signing up, we were already in the throes of the housing crisis. So it seemed that trying to find a spot in helping manage this sort of slowly unfolding mess that was the housing crisis would be an interesting place to be. And so that's how I wound up at HUD. And then from there, and I'll do a sort of sped up version of the bio from there, I was at HUD for about a year or so, plus or minus. And then the White House asked me to come over and coordinate the development of housing policy from the White House, so from the National Economic Council. And the way that that normally works, and this is true back into the Clinton era, and it's true to some degree today, is the National Economic Council brings together all of the senior folks in the administration on a given issue and basically runs a process for developing an administration view on whatever the issue is. In my case, I ran this for housing. And you're then charged with bring that to the cabinet for decision-making and then in turn bring it to the president for decision-making. And Dave was part of that as the HUD, one of the HUD representatives, and there were also Treasury folks there and folks from OMB and elsewhere. So I did that through the remainder of the first term, and then after I left the administration, sort of early in the second term, moved back down to North Carolina, signed up with the Urban Institute, where I'm a non-resident fellow writing on this sort of thing, and then set up a one-person consulting shop where I advise folks in and around the housing finance system on these issues, and that's what I do today.
Wow. And now I understand why there's so much wisdom and depth of understanding in the article you wrote, which we're going to reference again in just a minute. But I want to say thank you, Jim and David, for your service to the industry and service inside of the administration during probably one of the most challenging, difficult times ever. I remember, David, you talking about when you sat there and someone in the administration, maybe even Obama, asked the question, you know, what the heck is a warehouse line and why is it important? And I remember you sitting there explaining that. It's one of the times I heard you talk, and I was just riveted to everything. So I'm sure the two of you have so many stories that we could go into, but we really want to shift the focus of this interview to the article you wrote, Jim, and published on December 20th, and you published it inside of Mortgage Media. Again, there's a link to that in this podcast, and it says, what to expect from Calabria's leadership of FHFA, or the Federal Housing Finance Agency. It's a seminal piece. I think it's just so well written, and it's one where I read it and I'm going, oh my gosh, we got to get this out to our listeners. So first of all, what prompted you to write this, Jim? I think it's probably pretty obvious but by the title, but you know, obviously there's some concern in this.
Yeah, so I think there's a not just an industry, but among stakeholders more generally, so even among consumer advocates and other policymakers, a vast underappreciation for the role of the FHFA, so the regulatory body that oversees GSEs that Mark has been tapped to run, nominated to run, a vast underappreciation of how important that body is and how the mortgage market functions in who can get a loan, on what terms, how much they pay, and so forth. And so mainly one of the reasons why there's an underappreciation for its importance is the person who's been doing it for the last 5 years has viewed their job, that is in Director Mel Watt, as being making sure that the status quo is a relatively unbumpy place to be. That is, he hasn't viewed his role as being one of reform, of change, but of maintaining a healthy version.
Stabilization.
Of now. And that's not the case with Mark. That is, Mark has a long history of viewing the status quo as being untenable and as having put out a bunch of views on why the current system, that is why the Fannie and Freddie system that we all know and rely upon today needs to be overhauled and overhauled potentially pretty dramatically. So now you've got someone in the role that Mel Watt has been in traditionally, or at least over the last 5 years, who has control over the contours of the mortgage market that we know, that thinks that the mortgage market that we have today doesn't serve the system well, and so it's highly likely to change it. And I think folks in the industry and elsewhere need to understand his views with respect to the industry and where he might be inclined to take us, because it's not theoretical. This is something that will affect how people do their day-in and day-out business.
Well, I think it's so important. David, do you remember when you and I were standing together at the MBA, at one of the MBA conferences in Washington, D.C., and we were both going to be speaking, and you were standing at the hall looking at your cell phone, and you had this unusual look in your face, and he goes, Lincoln, come here. And he says, don't tell anybody, but they're going to nominate Mel Watts, and they want me over at the White House to get my thoughts on this. I remember that like yesterday. It gave me just a glimpse into your world, and here you are, probably on platform, you're trying to figure out how to go over and comment on that. And I had a bit of a skepticism about the job Mel was going to do. Not sure why, but I was wondering how that was going to work out. And really, to his credit, he has done an outstanding job. And you know Mel, David, so well. And so I'd like to give a few kudos to him. And why do you think he was such a good FHFA director?
Yeah, so first of all, David, what you should know is, you know, Jim and I both got to know Mel very well, and as did others, and we worked closely with him. I remember that meeting. I was actually called away from the MBA event to go over to a West Wing meeting, and Jim, you may remember that as well. They called in all the trade group heads to try to get us to essentially agree to the degree we were willing to support his nomination. It was highly controversial, and quite frankly, the Republican leadership at the time of the banking committee didn't really want us coming out and support. I ended up supporting Mel and got a dress down just before a Senate Banking Committee hearing where I was going to testify. Senator Corker called me into his office and lectured me about you know, coming out in his defense. Truth be told, in hindsight, even Senator Corker looks back and says how pleasantly surprised he was at Mel. Jim made the point. I mean, Mel did not come in and disrupt, nor did he expand the footprint either in any significant way. He kept the wheels on the bus running, and I've described this to the industry. I mean, Jim's got this dead on, but, you know, to make a point to this, the thing that's created this false sense of comfort with the role of the GSEs and the access all these lenders have across the country to it is largely due to Mel. And the personality who leads that agency can change things, literally shift it overnight if they view that the government's role is outsized and they want to shrink it. And, you know, Jim's paper goes into some of the concepts. But these aren't thoughts in the dark. Jim and I have both sat in meetings, and I know together at times, with senior leadership in this current administration who have talked openly about some of the pullbacks that Jim is suggesting are possible when markets confirmed, and he will get confirmed. So, you know, it's a really dynamic time we're facing. And, yeah, kudos to Mel, but he's out the door in just a couple of days. And here we have Joe Otting in as the acting, but Mark will be confirmed in a Senate that has a slightly larger Republican majority than it did when it ended the last term.
Yeah. And I'm looking at the opening paragraph of your article, and it says, the most important question in housing policy heading into the new year has nothing to do with interest rates, housing supply, or home sales. It's what kind of director of FHFA will Mark be? And a great question. And especially when you listen to some of his comments that you raise in this article, and Jim, I really, what I admired most about this article is you stayed down the center of the road. You stayed out of politics, but you raised some really good questions. And because Mark has made some very, very, to the mortgage industry at least, very disturbing comments as a commentator. And now, will those, as you suggest, might happen, will they be moderated or softened a bit as a policymaker? Get into that and what you both anticipate, starting with you, Jim.
Yeah, so I actually like Mark a lot. We're on different planets as far as how we think about how the housing finance system should function, but he is a thoughtful guy, not unreasonable guy. He brings to the table strongly held views, but unlike, say, Jeb Hensarling, who has similar views on these things, he is a humble enough sort of fellow that he will listen to outside input. And so it's important for people to understand where he's coming from, and assuming he does get confirmed, and I agree with Dave, I think it's highly likely that he will, folks are going to need to be engaged with Mark, because I think the more voices he hears, the more likely he is to, you know, take a more pragmatic approach maybe than he's advocated in the past. But the way to think about the question you raised, which is, you know, do we expect a pure, unadulterated version of Mark, the Cato Institute thinker that we've come to know over the last several decades, or should we expect a more moderated version? And I think what you're going to have is a very interesting tension between a relatively purist ideology that Mark has long laid out in a very consistent way, and economic and political reality. So let me talk that through briefly.
Yeah.
He has laid out a view of the system that really advocates a return to an originate-to-hold model. That is, he has expressed skepticism about the value of the securitization system generally, and in particular of the securitization system backed by the government. And so he really advocates a return to the kind of system we had many, many decades ago, which would be interesting from a panelist, but it's especially interesting from someone who could meaningfully do something about that view, because obviously he is, in some sense, the regulator of exactly that space that he thinks ought to be dialed way, way back. So that's on the where he is theoretically side of the equation. On the other side of the equation, you've got a market that is softening to some degree, and by that I mean it's tightening to some degree with originations slowing a bit in the face of rising interest rates and to some degree a softening economy. You've got that economic reality, which I think is going to play a bit of a check on how aggressive Mark is likely to implement his you know view of reining the GSEs in, reining the footprint in, especially when you think about the fact that we're going to move into a run-up to a presidential election over the next year. And so he's going to have to wrestle with, even though he's independent and supposed to be non-political, he's going to have to wrestle with the economic reality that if he were to move aggressively down the path he's long advocated, which would mean, you know, raising costs likely of Fannie and Freddie lending, shrinking loan limits, doing things that will both shrink their relevance in the market and quote-unquote crowd in private capital, so you've got other players playing a more dominant role than they have in the last 10 years. He's going to have to think about the economic impact of those moves, especially in a world in which economics are going to play a really big political role over the next year, because presumably that's what this administration is going to want to run on. And so you're going to have an interesting dynamic tension between his worldview and the economic and political reality that he's going to be taking his job within.
Well, not only are we getting Mark in as the head of FHFA, but we now have two heads of Fannie and Freddie. They're going out, and we're going to have them. So he's going to have an instrumental role bringing in the new heads. And I think it's to be anticipated he'll find someone of like-mindedness. David, your perspective on this, you certainly have worked in both the halls of Fannie and Freddie extensively, as well as HUD.
It'll be interesting, and I think the way I describe this is, look, we're all somewhat guessing, right? There's an uncertainty period.
Yeah.
Yes, we know Mark. We know Mark well, and Jim and I both worked with him for years. On the same point that Jim made, you know, it's one thing to be an academic and arguing policy when you don't have to make the decisions. It's a whole other thing when you're head of an institution that could have extraordinary effects on the economy and housing and potentially a president when he's running for re-election from the party that you came in from. So the GSEs are also an interesting dynamic. Don Layton, who is leaving Freddie Mac, and Tim Mayopoulos, who are leaving Fannie, they're entirely different people. Don was at the end of his career. He had no objective to build a new mountain and turn Freddie back into some big profit venture or stock gain for his own individual wealth. And he would always look very sort of altruistically and academically at various ways to think about the future of housing finance. I think Tim and the culture at Fannie was very different, and all of that created policies that either FHFA would play a role in approving or they would turn a blind eye to, which is what past regulators have done. I really think that what's going to count beyond just the Mark appointment is who Mark surrounds himself with. Mel surrounded himself with guys like Bob Ryan, who, you know, I worked with for a decade at Freddie Mac and brought into government at HUD, and he's worked with Jim for a long, long time and has incredible depth and could advise Mel with good recommendations. And so that's going to be critical to Mark, to have the content and depth of staff who can help advise on these decisions, and then how they interact with the GSEs and the kind of controls they put in place on the GSEs, so that if there's new, more aggressive leadership at either institution that wants to kind of expand their role, do more pilots, maybe do things that could, by its nature, by default, unlevel the playing field between large and small lenders. You know, there's this tension that exists between these quasi-private government-owned companies,
yes,
and the regulator, that are very difficult to manage. And even Bob found it challenging, I know, as the conservator, as part of his role. And, you know, having all three of these jobs change at once without knowing who the players are going to be, and particularly for Mark, when he's going to get in, who's he going to bring with him, and how's he going to adopt his philosophical views to something more pragmatic in the role of an actual director, you know, leads me back to the point that Jim and I and others, well-known people like Mark Zandi, et cetera, have been arguing for several years prior to this, is you better work for substantive resolutions to the GSE problem, or be careful when the next change comes, because the comfort you're experiencing under Mel won't be there when it's over. We're in that now. So it's a little too late, but now we have to closely watch these next series of steps that happen, who the people are, who the players are beneath them, and what they're advocating for, because we may like it, we may hate it, and it may have huge impacts depending on the kind of business model that you operate.
The housing crisis was brought about because, if you remember, David, and I'm sure, Jim, you remember the articles were published, do we even remember at the height of the growth of the securitization market, the CDOs and the Wall Street firms that were getting deeply into it, there was even an article right back then that said, do we even need Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac anymore? And yeah, that just scared the bejesus out of me when I heard that article, because I'm a 45-year veteran of the mortgage industry. I cannot imagine our industry without Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac being in there. And that we seem to have it figured out. We had an anomaly where Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac got that went into conservatorship on issues, quite frankly, beyond their control, and they were just in there trying to survive. So, I mean, I think we could go into all of that, and that's historical. We want to be looking forward, which really comes back to you, Jim. A question that you wrote in the article was, how will Mark, or how could Mark, reduce Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's footprint? Again, David, as you said, it's a guessing game, but I'd like to get some insights based on your knowledge of him and having insights into his mindset.
Yeah, so Jim? It's important to remember out of the gate that what they are going to be solving for isn't just reducing the role of Fannie and Freddie. It's reducing the government's exposure in the space.
Right, so, which was your second point, yes.
Yeah, reducing Fannie and Freddie's role is part of a broader sort of theory of what needs to be done. And so what they don't want to do is reduce Fannie and Freddie's footprint in a way that just pushes the lost market share over to FHA, because you're just sort of moving your problem from one government pocket to the next. So, yeah. And they also, so that's one binding constraint. The other binding constraint he's got is you don't want to, heading into the sort of market we're heading into over the next year and heading into the presidential cycle and all that, you don't want to, in shrinking Fannie and Freddie's footprint, shrink overall lending, right? So what the needle he's going to be trying to thread, I think, is how do you shrink Fannie and Freddie's exposure? How do you shrink their footprint in a way that doesn't simply move government risk from one bucket to another, and that doesn't meaningfully shrink the overall footprint? And so in some way, some may query whether or not that's possible at all, but that's going to be the nature of the effort. And my guess is, and it's just a guess, but my guess is that means that he's likely to move around the edges first. He's likely to move incrementally, and in ways that allow for some market feedback, so that he can figure out, you know, where he can move more aggressively. At least that's what I would do if I were him and had his worldview. And so with that in mind, if you think about the levers he's got at his disposal, he's got loan limits. He's got the authority to crank down loan limits. He's got pricing. He could crank up G fees. He could crank up loan level price adjustments. He could shrink the credit box. He could eliminate products. And so my assumption is, he pulls in at the margins of probably several of those levers. So let me give you an example. A lot of people talk about loan limits as being the sort of most obvious place to start. But if you were to try to crank back on the government's footprint solely through loan limits, it's a really dramatically disruptive way of going about shrinking the footprint, right? You wind up with a neighborhood that, you know, one day is on the right side of the agency line, on the next day they're not. I mean, that'll affect, you know, the liquidity in their neighborhood, it'll affect home prices. I mean, that's just a really sort of ham-fisted way of going about change. But there's a variation on it that, frankly, someone in the administration raised with me, which is why I put it in the article, that would come at this in a way that is more gradual and potentially less disruptive, which is, instead of, you know, cranking loan limits down to, say, $400,000, you might price loans above that kind of threshold at a premium. So, you know, add a 30 basis point premium to loans above whatever your threshold is, and that then gives the jumbo market a bit more incentive to come in and pull flow out of that larger loan space. And then for those loans that the jumbo market doesn't want, higher credit risk loans, for instance, you know, that banks don't want to put on their portfolio, those folks still have a place to go. They're more expensive now, but they can still go through the GSEs. And then Calabria and Company can look and see how the market reacts to that change, how much demand there is for that new highly priced product. And they can, you know, toggle the limit down so that more loans fall into that bucket, or they can toggle it up if there's not enough demand. So my guess is they're likely to play around with the levers that way so that they can see how the market responds, and they can move more aggressively if the market responds in a way that they like, and they can pull back if the market doesn't act in a way that they had hoped.
David, you and I both have looked at the impact of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in the mortgage industry. I'm concerned about, like Jim just said, he talked about them being more measured and working around the fringe. You both know this guy. I'm encouraged by that, and I'm encouraged, Jim, by your comments that you respect him. And I mean, even though you have different perspectives, based on that relationship, how is he going to work around the edges, or is he going to kind of have a Trumpism where he just, you know, damn the torpedo steering full stream ahead, this is why I'm going to kick this agenda in high gear? I mean, you raise a good point. We're coming into election year, but, you know, we have a Trump approach, which interesting at the least.
Yes, I go back. I agree with Jim, first of all, to make it a simple response. You know, Mark has actually been putting out some feelers to intermediaries to try to send the message that he isn't going to be as overbearing as some on the most extreme are saying. Nevertheless, there are, you know, depending on where you sit, there are great concerns. And I'll just give you a simple example. If you're an independent mortgage banker, and there's great data in the chart book that Urban just put out, the Urban Institute that Jim's part of, just released today, and they do it every month. But I was looking at some of the breakdowns of who does what in the space between IMB and bank and where they execute. But the one thing about independent mortgage bankers is they need an exit strategy for every loan they create. They don't have a balance sheet. Some of the banks on the other side, and you can see it in the Urban Institute slides, the growth in whole loan portfolio holdings on bank balance sheets has grown significantly. So depending on the seat you sit in, even a marginal pullback, depending on how they do it, and let's just take Jim's example of maybe they start increasing G fees on the jumbo end of the market, that's probably going to increase the value of whole loan bank execution, which could increase their role as an aggregator of whole loans and make IMBs, just simply due to execution, to price, might force them to have to sell through the bank rather than selling through a GSE. And that, in their minds, in IMB's minds, would, and you know as you work with them, David, it'll change their mindset into being concerned about their viability, because over the last decade, under Mel and actually under Obama, God forbid I should say this about a Democrat, IMBs have actually flourished because they've gotten a level playing field, direct access to Ginnie and the GSEs, and that's worked to their advantage. You start scaling that back, that changes that dynamic. So I don't think I agree with Jim. I don't think Mark's going to be ham-handed about this. I do expect the marginal kind of moves he's talked about, and I could see even additional attempts at things like cash out refinances, at least limiting under what circumstances they can be used and under what time frame after origination and what loan to value maximums can be allowed. Those kinds of things, because the general motivation of this administration is to crowd in private capital wherever possible. And we can debate whether that's the right or wrong thing and the alternate side of that. But their goal is ultimately just to crowd in as much private capital as possible, which means make the execution of the government transaction at minimum equal or slightly worse, if possible, so that private capital can get a shot.
What makes me nervous about that, David, is private capital is so finicky. I mean, we need a consistent funding source for the housing market. And I've made this on Fox and CNBC argument, and I get shouted down by all the people afterwards with a text message. You're on television way more than I am. And they go, you know, there's other markets. That's not right. Other markets in other countries have home ownership in excess of where we're at. They don't have a Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. How do they do it? And I sometimes wonder, well, maybe I have been just so influenced in having Fannie and Freddie been at the core of what I've been doing since 1973. Are we stuck there? What is that? How do you respond to that argument?
Well, the thing, and Jim could jump in here. I'm hearkening back to meetings that Jim and I sat in the White House with the head of the National Economic Council at the time. And he divided the room into hawks and doves on this exact subject. And the hawks were those that would argue that, look at other commercial markets, and you can look globally and domestically. They don't have a government backing. Why do you need it here? We would argue, and I think I was clearly put in the dove camp directly by the head of the NEC at the time, we would argue that you want to have functioning markets on both ends. But to your point, you know, private capital is opportunistic, and it'll be in markets when spreads are right, and it'll exit markets when spreads aren't. And so you need to have a continuous flow of liquidity to the U.S. housing market. And, you know, everyone needs to recognize that our housing market is unique to any other market globally, even any Western European nation, and its ability to consistently provide financing, particularly for low down payment first-time home buyers.
Yes.
And so to that end, you know, getting this balance right is what policy advocates have to do. I mean, this is really the role that we all play, is trying to control against the extremist position, because that will be highly disruptive.
While this is an argument we've played out now since 2009, that is not the position that the incoming FHFA director or nominee anyway takes. That is, in the debate about whether or not having the government stand behind the system is a necessary condition for a stable housing market that helps lift up home ownership without necessarily distorting the market. All the things that those of us who think a broad government backstop of the system is a good thing, all those things that we've advocated for a long time now, these are things that Mark doesn't agree with. That is, he takes the other side of his bet and thinks that if you were to extract the government's support for the system, at least the broad support for the system, you would land on a healthier, less distorted equilibrium in the market that would probably lower home prices in a way that no longer reflects the government subsidy of home values. And so he just comes at this very, very differently. So as far as your listeners go, and as far as the sort of nature of this conversation, it's one thing for us to argue among each other for why the GSEs are important or why the backstop's important, but we all need to understand that we're dealing with someone who is very skeptical of that view, who is now going to be at the helm. And so I think that means, one, being prepared for movement that sort of cuts against your own instincts about what makes sense policy-wise, just as a matter of, you know, preparing your own business. And two, it's probably worth going back and honing one's arguments about the importance of the government's backstop and how disruptive it would be as the government's backstop was withdrawn, because, as I said earlier, Mark is not an unreasonable guy. He may take positions that are a little out of left field to the three of us and to the people that are listening to your show, but he'll listen. And so we're going to have an opportunity to sit down with Mark over time and say, look, if you pull back loan limits by 10%, this is what's going to happen. Look at these numbers and look at what's going to happen in these communities to that withdrawal of loan limits. Or if you crank up G fees by 15% or whatever the number is, this is what's going to happen, and this is why you're not decreasing the risk to the taxpayer, but possibly shifting the market in a way that ultimately is going to be destabilizing. These are things which folks need to, in a sense, go back to first principles on, shore up one's arguments with numbers, and know that the first 6 months of this guy's regime are going to be important, because it's going to give us all a chance to bring him back to the center a little bit so that the change that he will push will be less disruptive than it might have been otherwise.
I'm encouraged that you both know him and that you're going to have a seat at the table. And we've sat with many people listening to them, and they seem to have an open mind. Do you really believe that Mark has a genuine open mind, or is he listening with a bias that's pretty much set?
I mean, I think Jim just said, basically said answered that question, which is he has a set opinion, but he's also reasonable, and hopefully he's got enough humility, as Jim referenced earlier, to be aware of how important it is to not go as far as he's sometimes articulated from his seat at Cato. In the policy world, it's good to have people with strong views. I mean, I was just as a relevant point, I was thinking of Elizabeth Warren's candidacy for president. I actually think she's good as a senator because you want that antagonistic view just so people have it there at the table. And if it's not there, then you don't get the perspective, the broad enough set of perspectives to make good decisions. As president, that's a whole other question. And I think with Mark, he's played a role at Cato for the last couple decades, arguing a very sort of libertarian posture, a conservative libertarian posture about the role of government. Acting as a regulator, I think he'll recognize that he can't be as strong in his views from a policy standpoint because he no longer has the luxury of simply, giving that extreme position, as it were, in the context of others giving other views. This time he's the decision maker, and the decisions he makes will affect the economy. So I think he will be somewhat rational. All that being said, it absolutely is not going to be status quo as it was. There is going to be change.
No,
I do believe there'll be a contracting, and I think people better buckle up and get ready for it.
Well, that's where I want to go next. By the way, I wanted to expand on Jim's response. I heard that, but I wanted to hear it. You really stated even more clearly. So change is coming. He does have an open mind, which is important that we be a part of the MBA and have our voices heard through the various means which we have the ability to communicate. So let's go into this. We wrap it up this interview with this. How should mortgage bankers prepare? Clearly, it's different for banks, that's what I'm hearing you say, than for IMBs. Looking forward, knowing that we have many more questions, and of course, and you do a great job, Jim, in the article, says this leaves open a great number of critical questions, and you did a good job of listing out those questions. I encourage everyone to go read this article, number one. Number two is I would like to get your thoughts on what should the various participants in the industry right now, how should they plan? What should there be their game plan for 2019?
I can start, and then Dave, you can fill in, I think. I would... there are a finite number of ways in which Mark can both shrink the government footprint and reduce taxpayer exposure within the footprint. Those are going to be the two overarching things he's trying to do. And they're not, but, there's a finite number of ways in which he could do it. There's loan limits, there's pricing, there's the credit box, and there are products. He sort of got those four levers to work with. If I were running a business in this space, I would play out what the implications to me would be of a material contraction along any of those dimensions. So what happens to my model if he announces tomorrow that in 90 days loan limits are going to drop by 10%? What do I do? How do I prepare for that? If he announces that G fees are going to go up by X percent or LPAs are going to go up by Y percent, how does that affect my business? How can I maximize revenue in that world? I would do exactly that across each dimension so that if and when he moves, you're not caught flat-footed, because he's very likely to move across at least one of those dimensions. And there it's a small enough number where you can prepare for it. You can think through what you are going to do in that world. He's not likely to move overly quickly. We're likely to get, if not notice and comment, at least a fair amount of runway before he puts in place whatever he wants to do.
Good.
But there's no need to wait for it. Wait for him to make the announcement. He's only got so many roads he could possibly take. You might as well figure out what your world's going to look like when he goes down any one of them.
David,
you got to be a voice. You got to be active. And I think people underestimate business owners, particularly small companies. Small and medium-sized companies need to know that their member of Congress actually does give a darn what they say, and so be vocal. But, as you and I know, David, and we talked about this recently, there are a series, tiers of risk right now facing the mortgage banking industry, interest rates, slowing volume, probably increasing delinquencies. And then on top of it, we've got this political factor with Mark Calabria coming into FHFA and potential changes at FHA, quite frankly, because the administration's looking mm-hmm. broadly. They don't want the businesses to go from FHFA to FHA. So
Right. Who
knows what that means in terms of overall housing policy. And so the risk of who your outlets are is now a new factor that could affect your business. And so good news for IMBs is they haven't really been as effective in the jumbo market. They're much more effective in the Ginnie space and lower balance conforming space if you look at their market share data. But, you know, this is another new contingent risk. And I think to Jim's point, I would be demanding that my head of capital markets or product development, if I'm bigger, that works within secondary, was scouring the earth for relationships with every takeout investor possible to make sure that I have choices when the time comes. And, you know, we're a terrible industry about planning. We react. We don't think strategically long-term when it comes to policy decisions like this. But this is one where the decisions that a new FHFA director could happen instantaneously. In fact, quite frankly, Joe Otting could come in and begin some of this immediately. And so if it were me, I'd be aggressively pursuing the what-if scenarios, as Jim just suggested, to make sure that I've got both takeouts in place and that I can consider what my options are if, in fact, that portion of my business is no longer available for me to originate competitively. And then where do I have to cut costs? I mean, in those two measures, we're talking survival through this period of uncertainty.
That's a great point. Great, great point. And how can people get a hold of the both of you? I have one more question after this, but let's get it. Since you both are advisors in the marketplace, how can people get a hold of you to connect with you to gain your wisdom or even you as an advisor? David?
You can reach out to me. I'm Dave at davidhstevens.com. And, you know, I'm helping others and obviously open to talking with anybody. And Jim obviously has clients he works with now that are in the space. He can give his information. But, yeah, you know me. You email me, you get a response probably within minutes, no matter when it is.
Amazing. So, I don't know how you do that. I need to learn how you do that response so quickly.
He's bad at retiring. That's how he does it.
He's bad at retiring. That's it. That's for sure. Yeah. I've tried that too. Retirement doesn't fit for me.
Most dramatically in his career thus far is retirement.
Jim, how can people get a hold of you?
You can shoot me an email at jim@fallingcreekadvisors.com is probably the best way.
Good, good. And listeners, we're going to put this contact information in the website. We're going to leave the topic of Mark for a minute and go over to Ben Carson. I've got to get your thoughts on this guy. I met him in the green room at Fox Studios before I was going on with Cavuto, and I think he was going on with whomever. I got to tell you, I don't know what to think. He is so soft-spoken, I had to lean forward to hear him in the green room. When he talked, he introduced himself, very pleasant, and seems like a very nice guy. I mean, but I've always questioned, can a brain surgeon run HUD? What's your perspective on Ben Carson, and what should we look for from HUD?
In this space is who's running FHA and Ginnie? Because I think Secretary Carson has been relatively deferential to the policy experts in the building, and so is unlikely to get involved in a way that is overly heavy-handed. So as long as you've got people that are running the housing finance part of that shop who are competent, I think folks should feel, in this space anyway, relatively comfortable. There is a fair amount of uncertainty there, though. There's a decent chance that we see the FHA commissioner, Brian Montgomery, move over to take deputy secretary, and if and as that happens, it opens up FHA to the a fair amount of possible change. So I think I would be less focused on Ben Carson just because thus far he has been relatively hands-off with respect to this, and more focused on who's in the FHA spot and who remains in the Ginnie spot is sort of how I think about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think losing Pam Patton out at DEPSAC was a big loss for the exact reason Jim just articulated. Now, Brian's acting DEPSEC, which, running the building, that's like this chief operating officer of HUD, and it's a very complex thing where appropriations and procurement contracts have to be secured. And, I mean, there's just so much stuff that's involved just to run the building that I don't know how you do a very good job running FHA. I am deeply concerned about HUD. I think they've, you know, Dr. Carson spoke at our MBA annual when I was still CEO there, just after he came into the job, and he pledged an end to rulemaking by enforcement and False Claims Act. Nothing's been done. The FCA is still alive, and taxonomy is not in place. And quite frankly, that's a difficult negotiation that HUD can't do on its own, because they have an inspector general who's got a different mandate about protecting the risks of the institution and ensuring that the departments live up to the written contracts that they're securing with their vendors that they do business with, which includes lenders. And you've got the Department of Justice, which enforces actions, and they want as much leeway as possible to enforce actions in any way, in any manner they see fit. And so to completely get an FCA solution done, False Claims Act solution implemented, requires really strong leadership that can spend time negotiating with the General Counsel's Office, the Inspector General's Office, and the Department of Justice. And a secretary that is not engaged just means that that negotiation happens at a lower level, and that's not always a good thing when you really have to ultimately make a decision. So I'm disappointed that really nothing's been done. It's great to have Brian in the job. He knows the business. We all know him. He can speak at conferences. But I look more at the policy side, and I'm not seeing literally anything happening. I do know there's going to be a push again for an admin fee and a budget. I'm not sure there'll ever be a real budget to deal with under this administration, but the industry is going to have to be aware of that. And more importantly, Michael Bright, heading Ginny, who's you know, very smart on capital markets and moves at a very fast pace, I think a leader like that also needs to have a strong secretary to be able to make sure that we're managing the downside effects of any decision made, in particular concerns about counterparty and capital, and particularly liquidity, as we head into a period where likely defaults are going to continue rising in the portfolio for a whole other set of reasons, which you can discuss some other time, is putting pressure on IMBs again, who may not be able to maintain the same access to the Ginny program as they've had in the past. So, you know, we've got Adolfo Marzola as a senior advisor. We all know Adolfo. He's been in our industry forever. We have Brian at FHA. We have Michael at Ginny. But in many ways, I'm not sure what they're accomplishing on behalf of the housing industry. The only real threats I am keenly aware of is nothing has changed on false claims. And I'm concerned for IMBs who may not be able to stake their case before being barred from access to the program at some level. And then I do worry about how funding is going to come into that agency for technology, and that could clearly come through this new fee that's been pushed for the last several years. So, again, nothing really positive about HUD today, other than we have a bunch of nice guys in these jobs that we all know, but we have a secretary who I think in many ways could get more involved and drive outcomes that he wants to see happen there so that his heads of the various departments execute towards that.
Yeah, I've been waiting for that to happen, and it just doesn't seem to happen, as you so well said. Brian does a great job. Michael's doing a great job. Both bright guys. So it's going to be real interesting. I want to thank you both for that commentary on HUD as we wrap this up. I want to say also thank you to both of you joining me today. I really want our listeners to go back and listen to this and share this. It's so critical as we get ready for what I think is going to be a volatile year on many fronts, and we got to pay attention. Now, what's the best way for people to stay up on what you're writing? Are you going to be publishing everything through Mortgage Media?
I'm not doing everything through Mortgage Media. I am doing a lot through there, and probably everything I write will get published on Mortgage Media. So I'd recommend, at minimum, everybody get access to this new platform. We have a great interview with David Licken on it.
Yeah, we just recorded.
And we did a podcast with Jim Parrott. So both people here, and they'll be on the Mortgage Media site. But there's a lot of good information on there that we'll continue to publish, and I'll be on there all the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, on your side, you talked about the Urban Institute. Yep.
Yeah, you can find everything I write, including this piece on Calabria on the Urban's website. So if you go on the Urban's website and just Google my name or search my name, it'll pull up all the publications I've done over the years. And I've actually done several on what one might expect from the next FHFA, not just the collaborative piece, but I did a longer, Mark Zandi and I wrote a longer piece on administrative reform that includes some of what I discussed in the collaborative piece and also notions of structural reform, recap and release, and other things. So it's worth, if you're interested in this, it's worth digging around on that site a little bit.
Well, we need to become interested, and if you're not interested, listeners, you got to get interested if you're a serious professional in this business. I want to say thank you both for your service to this industry and all the various roles you've had, and we're going to be paying very close attention to what you're publishing, what you're saying, probably more so even now, given what we have facing us. So thank you both for being here with me today.
Thanks,
David. Great to be here.
You just heard an audio clip from Lickin' on Lending. And here are the sponsors that make this show possible.
Scott Gordon here with a bit of sales science. Are you an authority figure? Behavioral scientists have discovered that people are much more likely to follow a person who is perceived as an expert. There's an important word you may have missed, perceived. Studies have been conducted to prove it. Physical therapy patients are more likely to exercise if their therapist has their degrees or certificates displayed on their wall. People are likely to pay a stranger for access to a parking spot if the stranger is dressed in a uniform. The therapist's credentials carry an air of expertise, while the parking lot officer is more an authority than an expert. The effect is more powerful when a third person introduces the expert. Even if the third party is directly associated with the expert, it doesn't affect perception. A group of realtors found that having their receptionist list each realtor's accomplishments before transferring customers to the realtor, their business increased drastically, 20% increase in appointments, and 15% increase in signed contracts. So ask yourself, how can I structure my connections and referrals so that I'm introduced as the expert? Instead of giving your cell number to every contact, why not use your receptionist like the realtors? Let him or her introduce your expertise and authority. Or use an answering service. They can talk you up before forwarding your now impressed clients. If this sounds too good to be true, it's not. It's just the science of sales.
As housing prices climb, U.S. homeowners are holding more tappable equity than ever before. Effectively capturing the equity market could pose a unique challenge for lenders who may be limited by the capabilities of their current loan origination system or consumer lending platform. Lenders looking to streamline their home equity business processes can benefit from Black Knight's LoanSphere Empower loan origination system. Using this robust and intelligent technology, Empower can originate both first mortgages and home equity loans on the same system. This single configurable solution will help lenders improve margins, support regulatory requirements, and enhance customer satisfaction. To learn more about Empower, visit blackknightinc.com today.